Well, welcome everyone to the CPX podcast. I'm talking today with Dr. Peter Walker. Peter Walker is from Wycliffe Hall in the University of Oxford, where he teaches biblical studies. But he's also spent many years touring the Middle East and the Mediterranean, and has used that experience to write two books, In the Steps of Jesus and In the Steps of Paul, both of which absorb the modern reader into the geography and the thought world of the Bible. They're both wonderful contributions, and we're going to focus today on the second book and talk about the Apostle Paul. Welcome, Peter, to CPX.
It's great to be here.
I was just wondering, to begin with, what made you want to write that book, In the Steps of Paul?
Well, having had the opportunity to visit the Mediterranean lots of times and to go in the places that he'd been, I was so inspired by thinking of this man wandering around these places on his own and facing these incredible hardships, and I just thought we've got to understand this man against the background of the context in which he was working.
So you're trying to take the reader, and you do this very well, from the pages of the Bible that can sometimes seem very foreign to the modern reader and place them into that world. Is that largely what you were trying to do?
Yeah, I think if you read the book of Acts, which is largely what we've got for the account of Paul's life, it can seem completely alien to people, and they don't know the geography and the places of it. And just being able to visualize what he was doing is such a help. I've been out there, and suddenly whole bits of the Bible have just come alive to me as I've actually seen, well, these are the mountains he was looking at, this is the journey he was taking, this is the direction. That's why he couldn't go here, because he couldn't get there because it was the winter, and that kind of stuff. So you get a far more sense of the practical nature of his ministry from it.
It's true of all history, isn't it? Once you actually put yourself into the situation that you might be reading about, it comes alive to you, and that's obviously been the case.
Yeah, and I found that actually one of the things that you really need from a historical point of view is to use your imagination, obviously hopefully historically inspired imagination, but as I say, being in the places, it sparks the imagination, and then you can actually reconstruct his life using some sort of human intuition and historical imagination, which is really helpful.
Now, Paul lived a very adventurous life, didn't he? His journeys around the Mediterranean, presumably at that time, were quite extraordinary. He went to many, many places. What form did these journeys take? Was he travelling around on a donkey? Was he walking? What was happening?
Yeah, well, we're not entirely sure, definitely walking, definitely on a donkey or a mule. The sailing season is between sort of March the 15th and October the 15th, the absolute latest in that part of the world. So whenever you're travelling in the winter, you've got to go by mule or walking. Just north of where Paul lives in Tarsus, which is in southern Turkey, there's a very narrow gap in the mountains there called the Cilician Gates, and that's where you're in danger of bandits and ambush as you make your way through there. And so we know that Paul will have travelled that way on several occasions. And he described himself having, you know, trouble from bandits, ambushes, being asleep, being overnight wrecked at sea on various occasions. So that's the kind of travel he was up to. We do also know on one occasion he actually took a nice quiet walk on his own. There's one case in the book of Acts where he actually tells his companions to go around the headland by sea, and I'm going to walk it on my own. And so that's the one time when we definitely know he's on his foot, on his feet, and just wanting some space and quiet.
A contemplative moment for him. But he led a very, very busy life. I mean, these are sort of epic journeys. He made a number of journeys in this region. And what sort of scale are we talking? How far did he get?
I haven't done the actual maths, but I mean, a lot of his journeys are starting off from Antioch, which is the sort of northeast corner of the Mediterranean. And, you know, classically it's described as three or four missionary journeys that he makes ending up in Rome. Each time he goes a little bit further west, sort of one loop to Cyprus and southern Turkey. Next time he goes even further around the Aegean. Next time he goes over to Illyricum, which is modern Albania. And eventually on the fourth time, although he's then a prisoner, he's on his way to Rome. And so each time it's as though the elastic is getting stronger or weaker, whichever you're looking at, and he's getting further and further away from his hometown. It's an incredible distance he's travelling.
Do you get a sense of the reception he received? I gather it was a mixed reception in different parts of the...
Well, yeah, literally mixed. I mean, on occasions, thoroughly welcomed. There's one occasion when, you know, they actually are so grateful for some miraculous work which he seems to have done, which they actually think, gosh, these are the pagan gods who have come down to us, and they think that he's Zeus and Hermes, and they're about to worship him kind of thing. Of course, this is a horror for Paul, and doesn't like this idea, and so tells them not to. But, you know, a few moments later, he's actually being stoned and thrown out of the city, and they think he's dead, lying there on the ground. So he gets this mixed reception, And there's a mixed reception also when he goes to the synagogues, which is where he normally goes to, the Jewish community who would know the Hebrew scriptures that Paul was speaking from. And he gets a very mixed reception of some saying, hey, this message about Jesus makes absolute sense as the Messiah. And others saying, hey, no, this is a disaster. And we don't like the way you seem to be taking off some of our fringe members from our synagogues. And then there's a lot of division at that point.
So it's an offensive message to those who don't accept it, in some sense.
Well, yes. I mean, Paul is talking to both people from a Jewish background and then from a Greek background. Those are the two main contexts he's speaking to. There would be people who would welcome it and not find it offensive. They'd find it great news if they wanted to, as a fulfillment for the Jewish people of a prophecies of their Messiah coming. But for them, offensive as well. You know, could they have possibly missed the plot? Could their Messiah have been crucified? That's going to be an offensive message. Could their religious leaders in Jerusalem have been responsible in some way for the death of the Messiah? This is very offensive. And then for the Greeks, well, the offense of one God now revealed in a person called Jesus and his resurrection, quite offensive. You know, when you see Paul going into Athens, he's really confronting the ideologies of his day very much head on.
Yeah, see, what sort of man was he? Did you get it? You've obviously really soaked yourself into this life of Paul. There's no doubt frustrations for you in that you'd like to know more, but
sure.
What sense do you get of the type of man he was?
Well, not an easy person to travel with, I'm sure. You know, he had really strong sights of where he was going to go, very determined, very much a frontiers person. We have a little hint of that in the book of Acts when one of his companions, he liked to travel in threes normally, and his number three on that occasion is a man called John Mark. And John Mark hears that Paul's going to go over these mountains, the Taurus Mountains in southern Turkey, and go into a place called Galatia over the hills. And John Mark says, no, on your bike, I'm not going there, and goes back to Jerusalem to his mother. So that's an example of Paul pushing the boundaries, really saying, right, I've been given permission to do this work by the Jerusalem church. I'm going to do some cutting-edge mission in this remote area. So you see something of that. But yeah, he also chose his companions quite well. You know, he had a guy called Luke who was traveling with him, and he was a bit more of a historian, a bit more of a writer. So you can see that Paul was probably interested in having the more reflective types around him as well. But as I say, a pretty tough person to be following, and yeah, full of determination.
Great determination for sure. I think of him in a place like Athens, and I remember reading this part of your book where he spoke to the leadership of the city. This must have been a time where he felt quite alone. There weren't many people in Athens, for instance, who saw the world in the way he now saw
it.
No
one, yeah.
Well, no one, indeed.
Yeah, well, that's one of the most powerful things, I think, from visiting these Greco-Roman cities around the Aegean that you can still see to this day. But Athens was obviously the summit of that. You've got to imagine Paul going into these cities on his own or with a tiny team, and he is looking around and sees all the statues there, all the mythology and the pagan ideology, which is symbolized in the way in which the buildings are done. And he actually believes that he's got the unique message for the whole world, and he's the only person in that city or town who knows it. He believes that God has done something unique for the world in Jesus Christ, and this is a message for all people. And if people will only respond to that message, then those mythologies, that pagan way of looking at life is going to come tumbling down. And what's it like to walk down a street surrounded by all these statues and think, I've actually got the message, which is effectively going to be like a bomb at the bottom of this. You know, it's going to go up in flames in due course, you know, 300 or 400 years later.
I get the feeling, though, that he was very skilled at tailoring the message to his audience, so he understood how it might be heard. I think in Athens there's a good example of that.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, he was really well placed both by his Jewish background, so he's really sort of the top of the class when it comes to, from a rabbinic point of view, trained in Jerusalem under the leading rabbis, so he knows his Jewish world very well. But he also, I mean, having lived in Tarsus, in a Greco-Roman city, that's where he grew up, as his parental home, he's obviously had some exposure to the wider culture. And, you know, he quotes the pagan philosophers on occasions, that kind of stuff. He obviously knows it well. And then he's obviously observing when he's going round, trying to work out how can I make a point of connection with this culture. And you mentioned the example of Athens, but exactly. He sees an altar to an unknown god as he's wandering around the streets, and he thinks, aha, that's a point of connection. Here are religious people who are hankering after something unknown. That's a point of connection I can then make. I will now reveal to you from the Hebrew scriptures and from my knowledge of Christ, the God that you haven't yet met.
Now, you have an interesting theory about what happened to him at the end of his life. It's somewhat speculative, as a lot of these things need to be, although no doubt well informed. He gave some people there, possibly in Rome, Christian believers, reason to not be that glad he was there. Is that right? Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, I'm glad you spotted that. I don't know how popular I'm going to be for pushing about this idea, but it does seem to me that when Paul gets to Rome, there are some of the Christian community who are not best pleased. You have this idea of Paul, who's determined to stand before Nero as the to show Nero that there is such a thing as a Gentile Christianity. And meanwhile, in Rome, you've got a really worried group of Christians. I think in order to understand this, you've just got to, let's go back a bit. In the ancient world, if you're a Jewish person, you were permitted by the Roman authorities to practice your religion. It was what's known as a permitted religion, a religio licita in the Latin. And therefore, it was a safe place to be, even if the Romans didn't particularly like you, they tolerated you. But if you were a Gentile and you were now wanting to follow Jesus, you had no safe place. There was no safe umbrella that you could go and run underneath and say, oh, well, we're really Jews, aren't we? We're part of the synagogue. And so the people in Rome, the Gentile believers in Rome, are particularly vulnerable at that point. What if Nero suddenly gets to understand that this is a newfangled religion called Christianity? It doesn't seem to be properly Jewish. It seems to be including non-Jews. And he's expecting people to be involved in the imperial cult, worshipping him as Lord and Saviour. They're in a very vulnerable position. So into that situation comes Paul, all full of his courage and hope, and he's going to stand before Nero and be very brave. And I think there are lots of Gentile Christians who are thinking, you're going to blow our cover, mate, and we're going to get it in the neck.
And they did soon after.
Well, they did. The Great Fire of Rome in A.D. 64, July the 18th, Nero blames the newfangled religion of the Christians for the fire, and that may be what happened.
Mm. Okay. Now, you say in your book that you cannot understand Paul without examining his Damascus Road experience. It really was a transformative moment,
sure,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously reconstructing that at this distance is difficult, but on the other hand, from the way in which Paul lives out his vocation after that, you can begin to see what he's clearly become convinced of. He's become convinced that he was entirely wrong, not wrong to be Jewish, but wrong to read the Old Testament in a way which didn't lead to Jesus as the Messiah. So he's learnt that he can be very wrong. He's learnt that Jesus is the Messiah of Israel and becomes convinced of that, and that therefore Jesus is the centre point to which the story, his own story, his own Jewish story, has been leading. And he missed it, but now he's found it. He becomes convinced that Jesus is the centre of the new people of God, if you like, and that therefore to be a member of God's people now is to be in some way linked to this Jesus, this Messiah. And that is his understanding of what the point of faith is. You know, faith in Jesus is now the entrance point for the Messiah, into the people of God. And that's what he's goes around the rest of the Mediterranean, absolutely convinced that you don't have to become Jewish in order to become a member of the people of God. Now, through exercising your faith in Jesus Christ, you have the right to become a member of the people of God. He's obviously convinced about the resurrection of Jesus as a result of that. He's had a transforming experience of a risen Lord, and he believes that the resurrection is absolutely central. He believes, therefore, that resurrection has become the sign of God's plan for the whole world, and he sees God's plan of new creation. And I think, finally, he's just absolutely convinced that through Jesus Christ, the God of Israel has shown this is the time when all people around the world can actually come into the kingdom. He's got this universal agenda now as a result. He's going to the ends of the earth to bring this good news to as many as possible.
Hence his journeys that you've talked a lot about. Now, would the pre-Christian Paul be thought of as an extremist today? And maybe even after he became a Christian? What would you say to that?
Well, Paul is kind of extreme, isn't he? I mean, he's that kind of character type anyway. But, I mean, to use the word extremist of him in his pre-Christian days, I think is probably pretty accurate, really. Yes, he is being raised in a very strong form of rabbinic Judaism, I suppose, there in Jerusalem. But he's clearly one of the most ardent and the most determined. That's why he's going off to Damascus to try and arrest these new believers in Jesus in Damascus. But I think in order to understand it a little bit better, I mean, it's just possible, actually, that his parents were political refugees who had been taken out of Galilee during one of the Roman campaigns, and they'd sent him back to Jerusalem once he grew up to actually get sort of rejoined the Jewish cause, and that he was actually probably quite an ardent nationalist, believing that the Romans shouldn't be in control, let's get rid of the Romans. He may not have been a fighter, a zealot, as the later terminology was, but he probably was pretty ardently a Jewish nationalist. And probably at the extreme end of that, some of the Pharisees were. He came from the Pharisee sect, which probably very, very ardent, very nationalist. And that's what entirely gets changed through his Damascus Road experience. He suddenly realizes the agenda for Israel, which he had set as a young man, was completely wrong. And that's very interesting. You then don't see any of that nationalism coming through in his writing. He's just convinced that to follow Christ is what it's all about.
Right, so the content of his message changes utterly, although the background to it remains.
It's the same background, and he also has the same ardor and fervency, if you like.
Yes.
You know, his character is not is an extremist character in that sense, but now the focus is extremely focused on Christ, and it's inclusive of people. Christ is for all people. It's not as though there's a narrow political agenda.
It's rare to see such a radical turnaround in someone's life. Can you think of any explanation for this if we were to rule out what he claimed, which was that Christ had appeared to him?
Well, not easily. I mean, he is a character who's going full speed ahead. He's in fifth gear, if you like, and he suddenly hits a brick wall and he's ricocheting back, and suddenly we see him going in completely the opposite direction, but with the same vigour and passion. And you have to ask yourself, well, what could possibly have stopped him in his tracks and bounced him back in the opposite direction? Because it is a radical change. Sure, it's difficult to really work back from that to anything other than what he claimed, which he did have an encounter with a risen Christ who was raised from the dead, and he was as shocked as anyone to discover that. It's not what he wanted to discover. I think one of the things which I think modern scholarship has helpfully brought to light is that some people have thought, oh, maybe Paul had some internal angst kind of problems, and his life was crumbling around him and he was deconstructing, and so he was so pleased suddenly to find this Jesus figure to be the solution to his problems. I think it's almost entirely the wrong way around. Paul didn't have a problem. He was going along absolutely fine, and suddenly he was confronted by something completely from outside himself which turned him around, and I think that's the kind of character type we're dealing with.
And his problems really did begin then, didn't they?
Yeah.
I wondered, because his life takes on in some ways, this leads me to my another question here, that what he was calling people towards and what he was experiencing himself was in fact, for those in the Roman world and that culture, that honour, shame culture, it's quite a shameful thing that he was calling people to and experiencing himself, don't you agree? And that
I mean, Paul is completely humiliated himself, as it were, by this experience of meeting this other, this Christ, in his tracks. He himself is blinded immediately. He then goes and spends three years sort of sitting in Arabia doing nothing. But anyway, from then on, Paul's life is full of this kind of being humbled, if you like. And he sees that that's actually part of what he's doing. He's calling people to a message which is upside down and which is countercultural, and where the things which they valued now don't have any value. And he talks in Philippians, for example, you know, all the things which he had from his Jewish heritage, which meant so much to him, and everything he could be proud about, now he sees as so much dung or refuse compared with the joy of knowing Christ. And he's basically giving people this countercultural message and calling people you know, to follow this Christ who died on a cross. And I think he's really ashamed. Well, he's not ashamed, but there is a sense of shame about this message as, concerning a crucified Messiah. But everybody is called to humble themselves before this topsy-turvy kingdom. Yeah.
And one final question. His most significant legacy, as you see it, he's had a large impact on the culture, but what's the thing he left us that's most significant?
Well, I mean, I think his last words to us, actually, in Philippians, which I take to be his last letter, is maybe slightly pious, but it's his last words, I think, are rejoice in the Lord. So actually, I think Paul wanted to have people to actually have a real sense of joy. But that's this kind of pious answer. I think his lasting legacy was this absolute conviction of Christ as being the Lord of the world. And the Christ was the true Lord, not Caesar, not Roman Nero, and that everything hangs together under this doctrine of Christ as the Lord of the world. And that's a doctrine which, of course, was disputed and is still disputed, and it gradually grew and people followed it through the next few centuries. But 300 years later, you're getting the entire Roman Empire to actually accede to this belief in Christ as the Lord, the true Lord of the world. And so, in some ways, Paul's legacy is the later Christendom and the establishment of the Christian Church. And that's a vision which has obviously gone not just around the Mediterranean, but indeed to the ends of the earth.
Peter Walker, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom with us today.
Thank you. It's been good to be with you.